Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is June 23rd, 2022. My guest is economist John List of the University of Chicago. He is the former chief economist of first Uber, then Lyft. His latest book is The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. John, welcome to Econ Talk.
Hey, thanks for having me, Russ.
What is The Voltage Effect?
The Voltage Effect is a description that tells us what happens to a program's effects when we go from the small to the large. And in particular, the voltage effect is usually a voltage drop. And what I mean by that is it looked great in the Petri dish, and then we scaled it up, and it doesn't look so great.
And you talk about the different reasons that might be true, and why don't you tell us some of those?
So in the book, I talk about five reasons why there's a voltage effect. And I begin with the simple one of false positives. What that means is, of course, a lot of your readers will know that it looked like it had voltage to start, but in the end, it really didn't. The data were lying. And what I mean by lying, they're literally not lying. You just got a bad sample. It's not representative of the underlying population. So false positives is vital sign number one. Vital sign number two is in many cases, we overestimate the number of people who can be helped by our program. So that's what I call know your audience. Vital sign number three is know your situation. In a lot of cases, we generate data that is really an efficacy test. And then we don't tell anyone it was an efficacy test. And then policymakers go and try to scale it, and it ends up that there's a big voltage drop. So vital sign number three is about a representative situation. Vital sign number four is about spillovers. In many cases, our ideas have spillovers, not only in terms of spillovers on others, you might go to a new market-wide equilibrium, but there are also behavioral spillovers. Think about a rule or regulation that causes people to change their behavior. In economics, a lot of times we talk about moral hazard, or behavioral economics has a discussion here as well. So that's vital sign number four. Now, as a Chicago economist, you might be thinking, well, vital sign one, two, three, and four, that's all on the demand side. What happened to the supply side? That's vital sign number five. Vital sign number five is, what are the supply side considerations, or does your idea have economies of scale, constant returns to scale, or decreasing returns to scale? And that's the fifth vital sign. That's essentially the first part of the book, which is about trying to figure out, does your idea or does the proposed policy have the DNA of an idea that has a chance to scale? And then the back half of the book talks about execution. It is basically a handbook that uses standard economics, behavioral economics to help people make better decisions, not only in their lives, but in the workplace.
The book's called The Voltage Effect, but in many ways, you know, I think of this book, which is a wonderful mix of applied economics and behavioral economics and empirical work, as illustrating what I think of as how the truth is elusive. Mm. It's hard to know what's true. It's hard to know when a result is reliable. And you spend a lot of time in the second half of the book trying to give examples of what might be more likely to scale. I want to start with a philosophical discussion of what it means to scale. Yeah. It's a technical term, kind of. It means to get bigger, to have a wide impact across a large group rather than just maybe the small group that you worked on. But in my reading of the development literature, there was an enormous focus in the early decades of the development literature, the attempt to help nations escape poverty, on programs that would scale, programs that would change the economy, create opportunity, create millions of jobs. And I feel like in recent years, the development literature has gone to smaller micro questions. Is buying textbooks helpful? Does deworming help students stay in school and therefore do better later on in their life? So in a way, there's kind of two senses of scale. One is, does this small policy, even though it's relatively small, it could help a lot of people, in which case it would be called, it would scale. But the other sense, I think people use it in the development literature, is more, is it something like a quantum leap rather than just a small marginal impact? React to that. How do you mean the term, at least in that setting?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So when I think about high voltage, if you want an analogy, high voltage to me gives you a chance to reach new people in new situations with your idea. And what I say in the book is, from the very beginning, if we're about making change in the world, we should understand what are the constraints or regulations or changes that we will be facing when we scale an idea, and bring that back to the Petri dish and add that to our A/B test. So I work with a lot of firms. I work with a lot of governments. Everyone today does A/B tests. They say A/B, they talk about...
Explain what that is.
A/B, think about a medical trial. You want to figure out if the cholesterol drug works. So what you do is you give the control group a placebo. That's called group A. Group B, you give the cholesterol drug. And then you look at some outcome that you care about. That's an A/B test. In development economics, in the broader field of economics, we also do a lot of A/B testing. Firms and organizations always do A/B testing. So do governments. Now, what that typically revolves around is, I bring forward the best inputs I can marshal. And in employing those best inputs, I'm effectively doing an efficacy test. So that efficacy test is important in an A/B comparison, but it's not very important when it comes to scaling. Why? Well, when you scale, you're not going to be able to employ the best possible inputs. Let me give you an example. So Steve Levitt was one of your guests. Roland Fryer and I started a pre-K in Chicago Heights, which was a school for 3, 4, and 5-year-olds. And this was probably the moment where Steve and I had the most contentious debate in our long friendship, because we were trying to decide which types of teachers to hire. Steve said, you need to hire the best possible teachers, and you need to leverage that this is a Chicago and a Harvard program and get the very best ones. Because he said, you can't go back to Ken Griffin with a null result, and you also can't get null results published in academic journals. So, John, you're an idiot if you don't just hire the 30 very, very top teachers you can. And I said, no, what I want to do is I want to hire teachers exactly like Chicago Heights would hire those teachers, because I want a test of the policy that's in place. Now, Steve was right for his purposes. I was only half right for mine. Let me tell you why. So Chicago Heights worked, and it worked in the sense that we helped kids in Chicago Heights. And we got some academic publications. Good and good. Okay. Okay. Now, what about scaling? So my idea was, hire the teachers exactly like Chicago Heights would hire them. So we hired 30 teachers. That's really good for horizontal scaling. So we could replicate that in Detroit, in Denver, in DC, in Vegas, etc. That's horizontal scaling. But if I wanted to vertically scale that idea, and what I mean by that is have a bunch of pre-Ks in and around Chicago, I might have to hire 30,000 teachers from that input market. no way am I going to be able to hire 30,000 really good teachers like I hired those 30 teachers in Chicago Heights. So I was creating a program that was a test of horizontal scaling, but not vertical scaling. Now, that's an issue when it comes to scaling, because from the very beginning, if you're interested in scaling, I should have sampled some marginal teachers. That's what I would call option C, or put in critical scale features into your A-B test and figure out A-B is your efficacy test and C is your scale test. This is a kind of constraint I'm going to face at scale. So that's why I want to sample those types of teachers. That's part of the situation, because then I can figure out, does my idea scale? That's where we fail as social scientists. We tend to do what Steve wanted to do, and then we get our academic publication. We forget to tell everyone else it was an efficacy test. So then when people scale it, it doesn't work. And then when we do it right, like I thought I was doing it right, I'm only half right. And I, at the time, this is 2015, I didn't really understand until I started to dig into the science of scaling.
But when you say half right, you, Steve, I like to hear his view.
Absolutely.
I wonder if he's totally convinced by now. But Steve was arguing, we're going to get the biggest impact of this work on these kids with the 30 best possible teachers we can find. You were arguing we should just get 30 pretty good teachers like this school might be able to hire. So I don't understand the half right part for you. What was half right about your part?
If I was primarily interested in horizontal scaling, that works, because I think every community can get 30 pretty good teachers. But if I'm interested in vertically scaling within the Chicago market, I think it's going to be very hard for me to get 30,000 really good teachers like those 30. That's what I mean half right. Is
30,000 is who are even pretty good, because
exactly.
You'd be digging down into the bottom, the left-hand tail.
Yeah. I'm going to get killed on the supply side if I keep the quality the same, right? Because I'm going to have to be getting day traders and Citadel traders, et cetera.
Well, they might be phenomenal, but the point I understand. I just want to make sure what you were saying, and the reason I love this is it really ties in with one of the other examples in the book, which is the challenge of Jamie Oliver's restaurant chain. And I've always loved the insight that the reason McDonald's is successful is that they figured out a set of procedures that someone could execute who was pretty good at cooking, but not a great chef. And that's it. If you need a great chef to run your restaurant, by definition, you can't have a big chain. You can't have a chain with tens of thousands of restaurants and the franchises. But the incredible thing about this is that you were trying to test a curriculum.
Yeah.
And so if it was going to be a real test of the curriculum, having the 30 best teachers teach your curriculum is not measuring the marginal impact of the curriculum. It's a combination of curriculum with the best teachers. And so having them be the standard kind of teachers, and you couldn't use the existing teachers in the school exactly because you were starting your own school. So you did have to hire from scratch, and you have to decide how good, special, whatever they should be. What kind of impact did you have on those students?
Yeah, I mean, in Chicago Heights, we had a pretty big impact. If you look at
It's a tough school district.
It's a tough school district.
Make that
clear. So, yeah, let's look at Chicago Heights. This is a school district in a city that the modern economy has left behind. This was at once a very proud community that had manufacturing jobs and a thriving local economy. This is a city that's about 25 miles straight south of Chicago. And the manufacturing jobs left. You have a community that is proud, but having its difficulties. We started in the high school in Chicago Heights, and we started in the high schools because when you look at their data, at least back then, every 1,000 kids that started high school, about 480 of them got high school diplomas and 520 dropped out. And these are families that are very fractured. But we realized that if you start in the high school It's very difficult to make big changes to a 15-year-old who's reading at a first grade level or doing math at a second grade level. So we helped some. Our best estimates there were we got 42 more people per class to get high school diplomas. So we're proud of that. But we realized very quickly that if you want to make big changes and game changing, or at least potentially game changing types of situational changes for folks, you need to go back to the earlier years. And that's why we started the pre-K. Now that first class, they're sophomores and juniors in high school. So we've been tracking
now
they're sophomores and juniors in high school. We taught them and their parents when they were 3, 4, and 5. So we're continuing to track them. And I think the results are relatively positive. There was some depreciation. When you look right away, we do a pretty good job of pushing both cognitive test scores and executive function skills. And some of those stick. So I think we still have a real result, but the result is certainly not as impressive as when they first went to kindergarten. They looked like we were going to really knock it out of the park. But I still think there's a nice positive effect within the check data.
Well, you might have knocked it out of the park if you started in elementary school. you know, it's an amazing result that you had any impact on just 3 years, and then they went on to the regular existing schools. It's a really interesting example of the scale thing. You said you only, quote, only got 42 more people to graduate. So it went from 480 to, what'd you say, how many more? 42, so 522.
520.
I don't know if that's a statistically significant result, because you spent a good class. But if you really did get 42 more people to finish high school, that's really extraordinary. But then, of course, as you would have pointed out if you'd written about this in the book, you want to look at the cost. Yeah. There are many things you can do with a lot. It was an expensive enterprise. 42 is maybe disappointing, but it is 42. Yeah. It's pretty good.
No.
Assuming again,
every little bit helps, right?
Yeah. So that's my counterpoint to scale. It's like I'm happy to help one person, but if it costs a lot of money, it might not be the best way to help people. You might be able to help too with a different strategy.
And that's my point about scale.
Right? I mean, exactly.
That's why I talk about why scale is important. And you know this, you're a Chicago economist. I don't need to convince you. Look, I love decentralization. I love devolution, but there's also something unique about scale that helps us to be a lot more efficient. And that's not debatable.
Yeah. So let's talk about Uber, because Uber's come up many times on the show. I've written about it many times in essays and in blogs. And you actually know something about Uber. The rest of us had no access to the black box, but you've been in the black box and you helped create the black box. So, and you did so also with their competitor Lyft. So to start with, talk about January 27th. Was it 2016?
Yeah, 2017. 2017.
Of course it was.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened that night. And I mean, it's really quite interesting.
Yeah. So President Trump, January 27th, 2017, issues an executive order on immigration. A lot of your listeners might remember that executive order like it was yesterday. People around America went nuts. Many people did. It caused the taxi cab drivers around JFK to go on strike.
The airport, JFK, to go on strike.
And they were going on strike because they were so angry about the executive order. Okay. So Uber at that moment had a policy in place that when something like this happened, a market disruption, they did not want to be viewed as price gougers. So they turned off Surge.
Explain what Surge is for people who might not know.
For those of you who don't use rideshare or don't use Uber, Surge is essentially a change in price, an increase in price that is trying to balance the market, because it's trying to balance the market because there's much more demand than supply. So the idea is raise price, hopefully bring supply on board or move cars to that location. And it also, of course, because of the law of demand, lowers the quantity demanded. Okay. So the idea is to try to bring the market back into equilibrium, but still have prices clear the market. rather than waiting time like traditional cabs had done. So Uber, in its mind, is doing the right thing here. But a particular taxi cab driver took offense to that lack of surge and thought that Uber was trying to break up the strike. So that taxi cab driver goes to Twitter, lets the world know, at least the Twitter world know, what he thought of Uber. And at the end, wrote hashtag delete Uber. That is a game changer now, because when you put that tweet along with everything else that was happening at Uber, and I won't even relive it. You can relive some of it through my book. I talk about some of it through my book, right, Ross? In the intro, I talk about my wrestling with Travis, and then I come back to it in the culture chapter. I'll leave that to the sidelines. But what happened here, this particular moment, is I'm the chief economist at Uber. We're actually killing Lyft at this time. Lyft has maybe 5 to 10% market share back then. They're literally waving the white flag. We're done here, right? There's nothing to see. Uber's going to take over. Well, all of the, let's say, events that happened around this time, and it happened that delete Uber, hashtag delete Uber, ended up being the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. And what happens is a lot of consumers and drivers start to delete Uber and they move to Lyft. And fast forward to today, I just got done, as Russ mentioned, as the chief economist at Lyft, we had 30 to 35% market share across North America. And the inflection point was right there at that moment, that Saturday night. So Travis came to my team.
Back the CEO.
Yeah, Travis Kalanick, the CEO and founder, came to my team and said, John, you know we have problems. You can see this. My team, by the way, was called Ubernomics. So if you type in John List Ubernomics, you'll see some stories about my team. And type that in Google. So Travis dispatched my team to start to think about how do we get drivers back online. And for months, I had been arguing that we should have tipping in the Uber app. And I wasn't getting much traction around the company. But voila, January 27th, 2017 happens. I'm dispatched to get the drivers back. What is an economist going to say when somebody says, John, what's the best way to get the drivers back? Add tipping, right? Think about a way to raise wages. So I ended up partnering with a few people around the company. One was Aaron Schilkrat and one was Daniel Graff. And we went door to door basically to the execs and we ended up winning. So when you win something like that at a company like Uber, then your group gets to help ship the product. So that's when I had some fun that summer of 2017 in testing a little bit about the Uber app, you know, testing presets. Should you put in $0, $1, $2 in the preset for tip values, or should you put 0%, 5%, 10%? So all that kind of stuff. And I've written a few academic papers exploring different aspects of trying to induce people to tip more through the app. And we learn, as you're going to find out in the book in chapter 4, we learned a fair amount about scaling through those exercises as well.
Well, there's so many fascinating things about this. First of all, I'm a big fan of price gouging and have defended surge pricing many, many times in all kinds of settings. And I want to try to defend it here. And in particular, though, I want to concede, based on an off-the-air conversation we had before we started this recording, that some of my arguments maybe is not as persuasive as I had expected in terms of the facts. So let's back up a little bit. So when you say we got to get drivers back online, I assume what happened was because so many customers deleted their app or decided not to use Uber, they probably didn't literally delete, some of them didn't literally delete it, but they stopped using it. Yeah. There was less opportunity for drivers and they started going over to Lyft, which is a different kind of equilibrium thing that's going on. As rideshare customers went over to Lyft, so did drivers. And so the tipping idea was a really interesting idea, and it's good to know that it's your fault. I hated it when it was added, because one of the great things about Uber as a customer was once it shows up, I'm done. I don't have to have the emotional issue of handing over the money. I don't have to have cash. So it's still, you don't have to have cash. I like that. And I was happy to tip. After all, I got used to that extra annoyance of going back on my phone and adding the tip, which is not annoying at all. Just different. Takes a while to just a little cultural change.
It's one so more really, click, I'm, Ross. It's one I'm more really click. And you can click I'm zero. Really, please do if you want to.
I don't like doing that. I'm really not mad at you. And I like to tip. And I tip even when... But here's the part about this. We're going to come back to the surge in a minute and my possible error. But I want you to clarify a few other things that listeners wouldn't know who are on the outside like me, which is that a couple things. Talk about the longer term. At first, the role of tipping did bring some drivers back to Uber, but the long-term effect was surprisingly small. That's the first thing. And the second thing was how many people tipped, which shocked me.
Yeah.
And normally I would say, that's ridiculous, but I think you know. So I'm going to trust you on this one. So tell us what happened, how many people tipped, and what happened to driver wages?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start with the wages. So what's interesting about Uber and tipping is that all the drivers wanted tipping because they thought that their wages would go up. It makes sense, right? I'm going to be paid the same amount of money and time and distance. That's how Uber pays its drivers. If you have somebody in your back seat, you're paid by how far you drive them and how long it takes. That's a typical formula. And the formula varies by city, but it's the same general formula for everyone across the US or across the world. So we add tipping, and this is now the fall of 2017. We start to roll tipping out in an experimental way because, of course, I do field experiments. So I randomly have some cities receive the drivers to receive tips, and other cities don't. And we do a nationwide tipping experiment. Jeff Woldridge and Ian Muir and Bharat Chander and Uri Ghanizi are all co-authors on these two papers that we've written. But the important element here is what happens is a very Econ 101 result. So you add tipping to the app. Drivers supply more labor hours. Some drivers come off the couch because they say, wow, I can get tips now. Some drivers work more hours. And what you find is those drivers drive around with an empty car more often after tipping than they did before tipping. And in fact, the amount of driving around with an empty car and its effect on wages exactly offsets the effect of the tips on wages. So what we have now is a new market equilibrium after we scaled tipping up to all the drivers. It looked good in the Petri dish when only 5% of drivers got it. It looked really good. But when all of the drivers received it, guess what? The hourly wages of the drivers, hourly wages are identical. Pre-tip and post-tip. And that's like a great Econ 101 story about how we've come to a new equilibrium and market entry matters. And the perfectly competitive model does a pretty good job in the long run predicting that wages will be similar.
I'm a big fan of that model. I used to teach it relentlessly to my students because I think it's a great way to organize your thinking, even though, quote, markets aren't perfectly competitive. No kidding. Of course they're not. It's a great starting place.
Yeah.
You know, I get it. The puzzle here that you didn't talk about in the book is you were there. You and Uber executives saw this. You could have raised the take, right? Now, the idea of in theory, it's not true, but in theory, the tip was paid by the customer. Now, that's not exactly true. Because that also changed once you add tipping as a norm, if it's an actual norm, you change the amount of rides people want to take because they realize they're going to be a bad person if they don't tip. We'll get to the frequency in a minute. But Uber could have overcome that if they wanted to, at least in theory, by raising the proportion of the ride that went to the driver, but they decided not to do that, evidently, correct?
Well, look, at Uber, we've tried several different approaches to raising driver wages. They did try to change the rate card. There's a nice paper by John Horton, John Hall, and others that shows when you change the rate card. What I mean by changing the rate card is giving a higher pay for time and distance. The exact same thing happened that I'm talking about here. So it's unfair to say that Uber hasn't tried. And the same thing happens with commission rates. When you say change the take, you see the same thing across 20 and 25% commission rates. Look, battling economics is not a battle you're going to win very often. And that's what you're trying to do here. And that's what Uber and Lyft have tried to do. And that it so far, as long as you have enough drivers waiting by the curb looking to make a little bit more money, these things are going to happen. And Hall and Horton have that really nice paper looking at that same effect with rate card changes.
Now, you'd have to make it effective, of course, you'd have to restrict the number of drivers, in which case you've kind of ruined the whole efficacy of the system, the whole idea of it. But because then you'd start to have customers waiting, which is offsets the whole value of the product, which is that it's better than a taxi because the wait's going to be eliminated effectively more or less by the role of pricing, et cetera.
And that's sort of against the independent contractor notion. But by the way, that's happening right now in New York because of the legislation there. There are supply controls around New York City.
Explain that.
I guess there's not much to explain. There was a debate about the number of Lyft and Uber and rideshare drivers around New York City some years ago. And we ended up placing supply controls in and around New York City because they argued that, well, several arguments, but one of them was they argued about congestion and about the effects of Ubers and Lyfts around the city. So we have gone through periods where there are supply controls.
But so that explains why the last time I was in New York in April or March, it was March, that I was shocked at how expensive Uber was. Is that the reason?
I suspect that might be a contributing factor.
Okay, well let's go on to how many people tipped?
Yeah, let's talk about tipping. So when we designed the tipping within the app, Travis Kalanick said, I don't want this to be simply a price increase. I don't want this to be restaurant tipping where everybody has to do it. The strong social norm, of course, is you do it in America, at least. You do 20%, 30%, whatever.
15,
10, whatever.
Whatever.
He didn't want that. He said, I want 10 to 15% of people to tip. Where did he get that from? I'm not sure. So we did a few things. One, we said the tipping decision then has to be divorced from the ride itself. So what I mean by that is the ride is completed. You leave the vehicle. You cannot give a tip until after the driver gives you your star rating. Then when you're long gone, but before your next trip, you are asked stars and do you want a tip? Okay, so that's point number one. And that turns out to be very important. That's what I think effectively moves the environment from a very strong social norm to one of, now it's kind of a self-image concern because I'm in my house or in my office and I open up the app and I say, wow, should I tip Jane or not? Sure, there's still a social norm around that, but that's internal now. That's very different than the social norm that we tend to think of around tipping. Okay. So we then, of course, experimented on the presets. We experimented on how to present the information and all of that. And we ended up meeting the goal when we did the tipping in the app. It's roughly 10 to 15% of trips are tipped. Now, what's interesting is the composition of who gives those tips. And I think some of the stark results are along the lines of only 1% of people tip on every trip. So Russ, you seem to be very confident and I tip this, I tip that. Well, Russ, you're in the 1% then. So when people ask me, how do I get to the 1%? I say, tip your Uber driver every time. You've just made the 1%.
But the problem I have with that, John, the puzzle that that raises is that how did that then have such a big effect on drivers, right? It couldn't have brought too many drivers into the pool. I guess it took 15 weeks for in your paper, in the book you talk about. I guess they were hoping they were going to get some tips. After a while, they found out, well, actually, most people don't tip, and it ended up back being similar.
No, I think that's right. I mean, this is expectations, right, and beliefs. That's one of our primitives, right? You have preferences, beliefs, and constraints, and they're adding tipping, I'm going to kill it. Now, remember, though, there's a lot of heterogeneity in who receives tips. So the marginal driver might be very different than the average driver. And we talk about that in the papers. But the other side of that coin is that 3 out of 5 people never, ever tip. And that's very different than when you look at the data on tipping in yellow cabs, for example, where we finish the trip and face-to-face, I decide to give a tip.
Sure.
Right? There you have 90, 95% of people giving a tip. That's very different than the restaurants where you have a large fraction giving a tip. Now, there you have social pressure, social norms. I want to do the right thing. I don't want to be viewed as a frugal economist, and you can put a lot of different words in there, a donkey, etc. So that's why I think it's a little bit of a different calculus, decision calculus, and that's why you get such different results across rideshare tipping and, say, yellow cab tipping.
You should add, because again, I spend a lot of my time in Ubers talking to the drivers because I'm interested in their world, but I don't know if every listener knows that we as riders get rated. You said that you're asked to be tipped after the driver has given you the number of stars. Not everybody might not know that. And also, I've heard a rumor that if I have a high rating from drivers, and you can look at it if you look for it, that I will get good drivers, that Uber will match me with good drivers who are rated highly by their customers in turn. Is that true?
I was not aware of preferential dispatch based on rider ratings when I worked at Uber or Lyft, but we can pretend it's true. So you continue to be a nice person. Like if that's what people need to be nice to their drivers, we can pretend it's true. But as far as I know, it's not true. Now, when you look at the distribution,
but we do get rated. And if we're drunk and abusive after a while, you won't send me a car, I assume, because my rating is so low.
There are different activities and actions that you can do as a customer that will get you kicked off the platform, just like if drivers misbehave, they get kicked off the platform. So there are certain restrictions in your behavior, but whether you're a 4.8 or a 4.95 or a 4.3 rated rider, now for all the listeners, the stars go 1 to 5. So 5 is the highest rated driver and the highest rated customer. As far as I know, there is no preferential dispatch around that. And just to be clear, though, the distribution's pretty tight. A lot of customers are receiving a lot of stars. And that's kind of by design, right? Because if you receive a bunch of ones, you might stop using Uber and Lyft, and that's not good for Uber and Lyft. So let's talk about what the incentives are for the driver, first of all. Now, secondly, I think what's kind of interesting about the star system is when you look at the driver ratings themselves, those only have a small influence on the amount of tips that they receive. So when we look at what determines how much the driver receives in tips, you can kind of break it down into 3 buckets. You can say rider characteristics, driver characteristics and trip characteristics. It turns out that the first of those, the rider characteristics, those are more important than the Huge. Other two yeah. combined. So it's really the rider fixed effect that is causing drivers to get a higher tip in terms of explaining the variation. It's much less the trip characteristics or the, and when I say trip characteristics, we have GPS, so we know if you're speeding, if you have a fast stop, a quick start. Those are all things that matter, but they don't really matter that much.
Yeah, that whole thing kind of ruins the romance I have about tips as an emergent phenomenon to incentivize good behavior. But okay.
Yeah.
early on in this conversation about Uber and Lyft, you said we were dominating Lyft when you were at Uber. Yes. And they had a 5-10% market share, and they were waving the white flag. There is some debate about whether Uber has any chance of ever being a viable, profitable entity, even with 100% market share, if they drove Lyft out of business, and that much of what Uber's play is an attempt to build ultimately a driverless car network, yeah. but that the current model is inherently unprofitable. And it's just right now, all they're trying to do is get market share and be ready for the world of driverless cars. Do you think that's true? Do you think Uber has a viable profit opportunity in its current
yeah,
mode?
Yes. So let's back up and first of all, talk about scaling. So
that's what it's about.
Yeah, this is what it's about. So Uber was able to scale this far because they don't need Danica Patrick or Michael Schumacher or Al Unser Jr. as drivers, right? Let's get back to the uniqueness of what's actually providing the service. It's one piece of labor, one piece of capital. And that labor can be people like me driving, normal people. So, okay, so we can now scale up.
It's a genius idea, but go ahead.
No, the genius idea is that we're using prices to clear markets rather than wait times, or rather than might makes right back in the day, right? Long time ago. So,
and to be able to find a trustworthy person who's a stranger who you're willing to get in the car with. That it's an incredible achievement.
It's an incredible
achievement. We underappreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. I can remember when I was raised in, I'm a bucolic. I was raised in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. My mom and dad, this is a trucker and a secretary, they would have killed me had I gotten into the backseat of a car, some stranger's car. They still don't understand it today. So if mom and dad are listening to this, they still wonder, what in the world are you doing, Johnny? Right? That's basically what they would tell me. And my grandpa's from Germany. He'd have that thick German accent saying, Johann is a fool. So then the model set up where you're right to an extent. I mean, drivers are taking 80% of the take. That's changed a little bit now that we've disconnected what people pay and what drivers receive. When I first started at Uber, those two were connected. So if a rider paid $10, the driver would get $8, and then the other two would come to Uber. Some would be used for insurance and overhead, etc. But now that's been delinked, and it was delinked between 2017 and 2019 in both firms. So now you have a little bit more of a chance because you can price discriminate by routes, and you can charge a little bit more, and then the driver doesn't always get 80 or 85%, 75, 80, 85%. Okay, so that helps a little bit, but I think you're right in the sense that the winner of the big tent, the winner of the big scale is either going to have to scale beyond moving people, so it might be moving freight, moving food, running a helicopter service. I was in the flying car division at Uber called Uber Elevate, or even move people in a different way than what we're imagining today, and also move freight and food at the same time where you have economies of scale by being able to move a lot of different things or services or products or whatever. You have a shot that way. But I think the biggest tent comes and the biggest reward will come to the player who develops autonomous in a safe way in a way that we can all trust and we can all allow to scale. And then it's going to be the owner of the capital who is going to receive those awards or rewards. And Uber and Lyft were both in that game. When I was working at both of their shops, they're no longer in the game. What they're, because they realized that they weren't good enough at it. And they ended up turning it over to others. I think Waymo, as far as I know, is probably still the leader in autonomous. I'm sure Tesla and Jaguar and Ford and others are close competitors. But in the end, it's going to be the owner of that capital. And then we'll see if the capital can be replicated or if the IP is so good and owned by one player. That's where I'm going to bet it ends up, a lot of the rents will end up flowing to that particular party. So that's, I think there are kind of two outs for Uber and Lyft. And the autonomous one is sort of the most obvious one.
Yeah, so my favorite Uber story is a driver told me once he took a guy from Washington, D.C., I think, to New York City. Maybe, no, it was Atlantic City. And I think it was a $1,000 fare, something like that. And the driver asked the guy, I may have told the story, I apologize to listeners, but the driver said to the customer, $1,000, I mean, you can fly, you can take a train, you could buy a car, you could buy a used car and it'd be cheaper. What? Why would you spend this amount of money on an Uber? And the guy said something extraordinary. He said, well, I'm going to a jewelry conference convention in Atlantic City, and I have an enormous amount of jewelry on my body right now. And if I drive myself with a rental car or I get on a train, I might get mugged. Yeah. I'm just afraid. And so I'm here. And of course, the driver being self-aware said, well, aren't you worried about me?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Why does an Uber driver take the wrong turn?
Right. And the answer, of course, is that Uber knows where he is.
Yeah.
And this guy was really smart. And just to illuminate the economics of it, which I find very beautiful, we step into the car of a taxi driver because we trust the brand, yep, the Yellow or whatever it is, to have filtered and screened the driver to not be a maniac and to keep tabs on them in some way that is reliable. I get into the Uber, which is much weirder because the brand Uber is much different. And the reason I get into them is I trust that GPS system and I trust the rating system to do the filtering. So it's a really extraordinary, and of course it's working with Airbnb also. And it only really works if people give honest ratings, which of course they don't exactly. I have trouble giving a bad rating even to a bad driver who's reckless. It's very, very, it's emotionally difficult. So it's a very interesting giant social experiment, these sharing and these different kinds of apps that have, and market interventions that have come along. But the part I want to clarify where I made the mistake, or at least was unexpectedly, was surprised by what you told me off the air, is that I've always assumed that surge pricing had both an effect on quantity supplied and quantity demanded. So quantity demanded, obviously, when it says, you know, to get to the restaurant you were headed to, it's now 3x. You go like, oh, I'll eat at home. Mm-hmm. Very important when there's something that lets people who have either a more urgent desire to travel or who have more money, it's both, to get your car, you step aside. Another amazing thing. You don't have to know what they're interested in or why they need to get away, or there could be something dangerous going on. You need to get home from the airport. You just don't go because it's 3x. But I always thought there was a similar effect on the supply side. A lot of drivers sitting, would-be drivers on their couches, get an alert from Uber that says 3x surge pricing. Go get in your car. Go drive over to JFK. There's a lot of opportunity. If they had used surge pricing that January 27th night. But you say that supply side effect is quite small. So talk about that, because that's surprising to me.
No, absolutely. So you're right. On the demand side, I can go catch a train, I can catch a cab, or I can just stay home. I just don't use the service, or I use Lyft.
Or go later.
Yeah, go later.
Go in a couple hours to
whatever. Intertemporal substitution is important. On the supply side, there are sort of three ways in which you can bring on a little bit of extra supply in those situations where there's an unanticipated surge. So you can have a person make an extra trip. So instead of going home, I'm going to take one more trip because it's 3x. You can have a car relocate and there's some relocation, or you can have just totally new supply coming on board. A person sitting on their couch and they have their app open and they see a heat map and 3X, 5X, 10X, whatever. That third one isn't as large as what most believe. In my analysis of both Uber and Lyft data, if you really want to combat the type of problem like the New York Yankees baseball game just got let out, or the Mets game got out, or the Patriots just finished in Foxborough, you really need to set up longer term incentives and set up things like, if you drive around RFK Stadium in DC around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when the Redskins have an early game, the game will end around 3 or 3:30 PM or 4, 4:30 PM on East Coast time, you'll receive guaranteed surge. And companies do that because a lot of surge is predictable. A lot of surge is, we know when events happen, and we can make sure to move around supply. And we let people know that on Sunday night, that on Thursday night, there's an NBA game happening at the Garden in New York City, and we're going to make sure to have extra cars around there. That works. So people will shift around their effort during the work week when they can schedule it. What doesn't work as well is an unanticipated 3X getting a person off the couch. That's in our imaginations. If we think that that's real, that will not, in my time at Uber and Lyft, I never really saw that having a deep impact in terms of the supply curve affecting the price, and then this great number more of trips occur at an affordable price. I think that's more dreaming than reality.
Which means that the price goes up more than it otherwise would, I assume, because you need to choke off some of that demand. If the goal of the algorithm is to always ensure a relatively short wait, which is the bread and butter. And I just also want to add, all this is, again, enormously fabulous. To me, it's better to have the possibility of having a ride than no ride at all. There's a fixed number of taxi medallions in New York. They, I'm sure, are used more often on a rainy night. I assume they maybe are used more often on a rainy night than on a exit of a game. But it's still fixed. Mm-hmm. And at least with the Uber, you do have this possibility for – there's more of a possibility, yeah, of increased supply. And certainly in the long run, if an area is growing. I mean, I think the number of medallions in New York City hasn't changed since 1936 or something.
Wow.
That's what we used to say. Something – like, don't say wow. It might not be true. But listeners, you can help me out there. And I suspect, for those listeners who remember bootlegger and Baptist regulation, I suspect that the restrictions on supply that New York City's imposed, true, they could argue it was for congestion, but I'm sure some of it was response to medallion holders trying to maintain the value of their asset.
Nah, you wouldn't think rent seeking's at work, would you, no, Russ? I can't believe you said those words.
I didn't. You said them. Okay. I want to move to an example that it's based from your experience at Lyft.
Yeah.
But it's an incredibly valuable general principle, which is the difference between marginal and average. Sure. And talk about what that meeting you were at Lyft and what jumped out and how it came up.
No, absolutely. So let's start with a caveat that I could tell a story like this from my days in the White House, from my days at Uber, from my days at Lyft, from my days in any organization. So my folks at Lyft, please don't kill me when you hear this and you read it in the book. Okay. So that said, there are various groups in Lyft that are tasked with doing certain chores. The one group I was talking to on a certain afternoon was responsible for bringing in more drivers to the Lyft platform. Okay. So their typical mode of operation is to place advertisements. And they ended up placing ads on places like Facebook and Google. And they were in a mode of Logan Green, the founder and CEO of Lyft, gave them a new tranche of dollars and said, bring in as many drivers as you can. So they came to me with some data. And the first tranche of data that they gave me said, you know, for the last 1,000 drivers that we've brought in through Facebook ads, it's cost about $500, $300 to $500 per driver on average. Okay. And then they showed me the same data for the last 1,000 drivers from Google ads, and it was about $700 on average. So they said, with this new tranche of dollars, we're going to do it and spend our money on Facebook ads. Makes perfect sense, doesn't it, Russ?
Data told, let the data speak.
Evidence-based decision-making, Russ. Evidence-based decision-making. So I said, look, 1,000 drivers on each, that's a lot. Is there any way you can tell me, say, about the last 25 or 50 drivers? They said, we don't have that. But we'll send you that tonight. So that evening, they sent me an email, and they said, Professor, on Facebook, the last 25 drivers were about $1,000 each. And on Google, the last 1,000 were like $750 each. And they said, we understand your point. We wish we could go back and move some of those Facebook dollars to Google. But now moving forward, we're going to actually invest in Google ads instead of Facebook, because the last few is the most predictive of the next few. So it's not exactly marginal thinking the way we teach it in our class, where we say, what's the benefit of the next dollar spent? That's marginal benefit. And what's the cost on the margin for the next unit we produce? But it's closer than the average.
It's close.
So yeah. What the point of this chapter is anytime you can take thinner slices of data, you should do so. Now, the misnomer that a lot of us have is just add and add data, and because your estimates become more precise, they're going to be more informative. That's a typical way to think about it, right? Big data, we estimate a regression, the standard errors of the regression become very precise as we add sample, because we know that N is in the denominator of the variance term, okay? So that makes perfect sense. But the point here is, if you add data from a different regime or a long time ago, that can be very misleading when you're making your decisions. And anytime you can take a thinner slice of the data, that will lead to a much better decision. And it's what we call thinking on the margin. And we teach this all the time. But I've taught principles for 25 years. And I always get the feeling that when students walk out, they've memorized a concept and they can write it down mathematically. But when it comes time to take that concept and put it to use, fails. And let's be honest, Logan Green, he's an econ undergrad major.
Smart guy.
Very smart guy. Very clever guy. An econ undergrad from UC Santa Barbara. He's smart, but it's just not first nature to think, I need to look at this on the margin. So as I write about in the book, I wrote what I called the Adam Smith memo. And the Adam Smith memo was a simple memo on and about thinking on the margin. And it gained traction during COVID because we had to find a way to downsize in an efficient manner. That morning, we cut 22% of our workforce. And Logan said, we need to cut even more spending. That's when ideas tend to have a chance, is when people are desperate. They say, okay, we need a new way to think. And when change has to be made, that's when the Adam Smith memo, I published that all around left and became a very famous memo, because it gave people a proper guide. And it makes sense after you hear it, right? There are dollars strewn all over the ground, as I write about in that memo. And here's a way that we can pick some of them up and save a little bit for not only customers, but also shareholders and the firm. And once you start to think that way, people readily see it works. So that's literally what Lyft is going through right now, is a bunch of Adam Smith thinking. and making decisions on the margin.
Well, I think I would have called it the Menger memo, a name you do mention in the book for marginal thinking. Yeah. But Adam Smith is a little better known. It probably got people's attention. So that's probably
just a little bit better known. Just a little bit better known.
Just a titch. My guest today has been John List, and I'd love to talk to him more about what's in his book, but he has to go to class.
I do.
So the book has many, many other things, but I appreciate, John, you sharing your special insight from your Uber and Lyft experience and your general insight as a field experimenter. And thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Russ, thanks so much for having me, and have a great day, everyone.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.